My instinct is that there is another element that's skewing the results.
You think you found an undiscovered element?
If you're laughing at me, then I'm...
No, I'm not laughing at you. That's exciting.
Marie and Pierre Curie consider the possibility that they've discovered radium in that scene from the movie Radioactive, one of only a few films that focus on the work of a woman scientist. Most of those films are about Marie Curie, and if you were to ask someone to name a female physicist or chemist, Marie Curie is almost certainly the answer that you'd get. Quantum physicist Shohini Ghosh aims to widen the field with a new book titled Her Space, Her Time, which profiles Curie and more than a dozen other women who made scientific history, even though they were pushed out of the spotlight at the time. Greetings, Earthlings. I'm Alan Boyle, one of your hosts for the Fiction Science Podcast, coming to you from the place where science intersects with fiction. Join me and my co-host, science fiction author Dominika Fetteplace, as we talk with Shohini Ghosh about hidden figures in physics and astronomy. In her day job, Shohini Ghosh explores the frontiers of quantum physics and computer science at Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada, but she's also on a personal mission to highlight the contributions of women physicists in previous generations, including not only Marie Curie, but lesser-known figures such as Anna Draper, Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, Henrietta Leavitt, and Lisa Meitner. If those names don't sound familiar to you, they will after reading Her Space, Her Time. Ghosh's book traces how women physicists and astronomers have deepened our understanding of phenomena ranging from the structure of the atom to the Big Bang and the nature of stars, galaxies, and our expanding universe. For Ghosh, the road to writing Her Space, Her Time began with a TED Talk she presented in 2019, and that's where Dominika Fetteplace and I started our conversation with the author. Give a listen.
I did do a TED Talk a few years ago now about women scientists who've been ignored by the Nobel Prize Committee, and this was in the context of TED India. So I talked a little bit about, you know, the experiences of scientists in India and some of the metrics and statistics there. But turns out, in fact, this issue around having low representation of women in physics is something that's common all around the world. And I've certainly faced it in my own experiences as a physicist. Growing up, I really didn't know of any women physicists, really, apart from Marie Curie. I was actually sad to find out that I didn't know about this Bengali woman in physics, because I myself am Bengali, and growing up, I never heard about this woman. Her name is Bipa Chowdhury, and she was involved in the discovery of two fundamental particles in nature. So these are really big discoveries, and yet she was not really acknowledged or celebrated for it during her own time. So part of the reason I wrote this book is that it's a celebration of the many, many women who have contributed to almost every major discovery in physics and astronomy, but have not really been recognized. And part of the reason they're not recognized is because there are still lots of challenges that we face today in the field, being women or from, you know, being individuals from underrepresented minorities. And those challenges were the very same ones that these women faced too. So I think there's lots of stories of both of scientific discovery and overcoming barriers and challenges that are really both difficult to, you know, read about, but also very inspirational. So that's why I thought they were worth telling these stories.
Throughout the course of this book, you profile many women scientists, but you also weave in aspects of your own story and your own journey as a scientist. You're also mentioning things you wish your students knew because you're also a professor. So is that how you're kind of thinking of this book when you wrote it? And is there a particular target audience for this book?
Sure. I feel like this book was always in the making throughout my career, because when I was a student, often I was the only woman in the room. It was quite lonely. It made me question whether I belonged there and whether I had the skills to be a physicist. And for a while, initially as a student, I actually ignored all of the women in physics clubs and organizations because I wanted to prove myself as a physicist, not as a woman who needed extra help. But then over the years, when I started looking into the whole problem more as almost like a scientific problem, as in why is it that there are fewer women in the classroom? And what are these so-called skill sets? Who makes a good scientist? What is a scientific identity? Once I started asking those questions more carefully, then that's when I found out that, of course, it isn't a level playing field. There are lots of other factors. It's not just about me and my skill sets. And I want future generations of potential physicists to know that and not to only question themselves. If you are curious about how the universe works, absolutely, you can do science. So that's kind of where I was approaching it from. And I hope that, you know, my readers will get that sense of inspiration and the fact that everybody could contribute to science if they have a passion for it. So I hope we go beyond just readers who are already interested in science or know what the field is all about. Think about science as being something that really impacts everybody and should include everybody.
And there are really a lot of fascinating life stories, really a lot of fascinating profiles. I learned about so many women I should have known about before. You mentioned one, Bipa Chowdhury. Is there anyone in particular, as you're thinking about it now, that really, someone you've profiled in your book that you really feel like deserves a lot more recognition than she gets or got?
Wow, there are so many of them. I don't know where to start. But yeah, sure, I will mention one who is very close to my heart just because she inspired me in my own field, which is quantum physics. So this was a woman named Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin. And she was actually the first person to do a PhD in physics at Harvard Observatory back in the early 1920s. And what she did was she used the theory of quantum physics, which at the time was a pretty new area to be working on, where people were not really sure yet what the theory was all about and how to use it and apply it. And here was this student who was able to use these new mathematical equations and apply them to understand the composition of stars. And she found out that, in fact, although stars look very different when you look at the, you know, collect their light from the stars and then you use a prism to break them up into all the different colors, stars tend to look different. There's, you know, more blue stars, and then there are some that are more the, you know, the red spectrum side of, you know, stars and so on. But she found out that when you apply the equations correctly, that although these stars look very different in their spectra, they actually all are composed primarily of hydrogen and helium, which is not surprising to us today because we know that the universe is mostly hydrogen and helium. But back then, that was not known. In fact, it was her work that actually...
I thought that was so weird. People were expecting all these other elements. It's like, why did people think that?
Yeah, that's how much we take it for granted today, right? But back then, we knew about the composition of Earth, obviously. That's what we knew most about. So it seemed natural to think that the universe was kind of like that, because why would Earth be very different from everything else? And we kind of tend to be very, you know, inward looking, I guess. In the beginning, we used to think that the Earth was the center of the universe. And it took a while even to move away from that. And so moving away from the fact that Earth is also not the composition that is common in the universe was the next step. And this is where Cecilia Payne's work came in, because she showed it, she calculated it and proved it. But because there was so much skepticism, even her own PhD committee, they acknowledged that her work was very high quality, very impressive. But they weren't quite sure if it was correct. How could it possibly be true? So she actually added a sentence in her thesis saying that the results may not be correct. But she earned her PhD, went on to do more research at Harvard, was not given an official title as astronomer, although she had this amazing work and lots of impact. And she taught courses, but they were not even listed in the books because she was a woman without an actual official faculty position there. But she persisted and, you know, did so much amazing work there while she was there, became the acknowledged expert in her field, wrote several amazing books. And eventually, she was so good that she basically forced them to change their rules. And eventually, she became the first first woman chair of any department at Harvard, and that was the astronomy department. And so I find her story very inspiring, particularly because she was one of the early users of quantum physics. And she's now more well acknowledged in the field of astronomy for her impact. But in the story of quantum physics, she's still not really part of that history at all. So I hope that changes.
You've said that the James Webb Space Telescope might have been better named the Henrietta Leavitt Space Telescope. Can you tell us a little bit more about why her name might be more fitting for this telescope?
Yes, absolutely. Henrietta Leavitt was also an amazing astronomer who also was based actually at Harvard. So Harvard has had a nice history of women working there in the early days. Actually, they were all initially hired because they were paid half the wages of the men there. And they were hired to analyze all of this light that was being collected by the telescopes and to calculate how much of each color of light you could see and then use them to create patterns and catalogs. And so women like Leavitt, they were called computers and not astronomers at Harvard. And their job was to do all of that cataloging. And they cataloged hundreds of thousands of stars, built the first such large catalog of stars, which is still used today. And there were women in that group because they knew all of that data. They were actually able to find patterns in those catalogs of stars and create a whole star classification system. So these days, you know, if you watch Star Trek like me, you'll hear, you know, somebody on the show will say, whoa, we have reached this class M star or the G class star below and so on. Well, that's actually real classes of stars created by these women in Harvard. And one of those women was Henrietta Leavitt. Not only was she looking at cataloging stars, she actually noticed this particular group of stars that are called variable stars. And they're called variable because they actually change in their brightness over time. So they become brighter and dimmer. And she noticed that there's a pattern to their cycle of brightness, brightening and dimming. And from that pattern, you can actually figure out how far a star is. So the brighter a star is, it has a different period of oscillation of brightness compared to another star, which is perhaps not as bright. So based on that, she could figure out how to use it as a cosmic measuring stick, really. And that's really important because, to be honest, it's really hard to know how far stars are because if you just look up at the sky, there's no real, you know, sort of nice way to tell just by your eye or by regular ways of measuring distances, you know, where you would just like maybe figure out, oh, how fast can you travel to the nearest star and back? And then that'll tell you the time. Well, we can't travel to the nearest star and back. So this was really important. It allowed astronomers to measure distances to very faraway objects and galaxies. And in fact, one such astronomer used that technique using this variable star method to figure out that the further away galaxies are, the faster they are moving away from us. So he used this distance measure to measure figure out what the distances were, and then also measured how fast they were moving. And this relationship between distance and speed of moving away from Earth is actually a signature of an explosion. And that was the first evidence of the Big Bang, that something started out and now things are still moving away from each other, just like you would have in an explosion, explosive kind of start. So this evidence of Big Bang was discovered by Edwin Hubble and his colleague, Humason. And that's why our most famous telescope is called the Hubble Telescope, because of his contribution, which was quite amazing, of course, and really transformed our understanding of the universe. And he did acknowledge that he used Leavitt's work, but Leavitt did not get the recognition, really, that Hubble did, because, I mean, Hubble's name, everybody knows his name now, thanks to the telescope. But NASA never actually celebrated Leavitt by naming a telescope after her. And none of the major space telescopes have a woman's name attached to it. So when the James Webb was being planned, before it was called James Webb, I was very excited. I was hoping they would name it after Leavitt or any of the other women who have contributed. But I was really hoping for Leavitt, but you know that didn't happen. Hopefully that'll change and the next big telescope will be named after Leavitt.
And there was a controversy over the James Webb name because James Webb had a role in discrimination against basically LGBT LGBTQ folks before they were known as LGBTQ back in the 50s and 60s, I think. And so that was another factor that some people said, well, maybe we should find a different name for this telescope because of that history. But NASA decided to stick with James Webb for the telescope name.
Right, yes. So there are many reasons why we can do better with our naming. Hopefully NASA will learn and do better next time.
Well, now the Vera C. Rubin Observatory and the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope are in the works. And are these signs that indeed the invisibility of women scientists is starting to lift?
I hope so. I think that we can certainly keep doing better and go back and correct some of these historic sort of misses. But I also want to mention that the Vera Rubin Telescope is not the first telescope named after a woman. As I mentioned in my book, actually back in the days when, you know, these women at Harvard were analyzing all the data collected from stars, that whole project was funded by women who happened to, you know, be interested in supporting this kind of work. One of them was a woman named Anna Draper, who actually created this Draper Memorial Fund in her husband's name. She and her husband used to be, you know, very, very passionate observers of the universe through their homemade telescopes. And when he died, she provided the funds to Harvard Observatory to start this cataloging of stars. But there was this other woman who also provided funds, and her fund was used to build a new telescope in the southern hemisphere so they could look at the southern hemisphere stars. And that was named after Mrs. Bruce, the Bruce telescope, back in the early 1900s. So we did have women who supported this work, and we do have telescopes named after them, but we don't even know that happened, because when Rubin was announced as a name for this new telescope, people did celebrate that as, you know, the first such naming, but it was actually not the first.
Uh-huh. Besides coming up with better telescope names, what more can be done to raise the profile of women in science?
That's a great question. I think you're absolutely right. We shouldn't just aim for renaming telescopes. That's just part of a much bigger issue that women have been facing for a long time. And I'd say there's basically, you know, some very specific practical barriers that we still see. For example, there's still a gender wage gap. There's issues around fair hiring practices. There's been surveys and studies that have shown all around the world, women in physics and astronomy certainly report having fewer resources for their research. They have slower paths on their career journeys, so that they don't get promoted as much. They don't get invited as much to give talks at major conferences, which are really important if you want to get those promotions. Grant funding rates are lower for women. So there are this whole series of issues, and these are structural problems. If women are not being funded equally or fairly, then we can change that. Or if women are not being, provided the same level of wages, that can, of course, change. Or being given opportunities for their research and, resources and so on. So for me, yeah, these are still, you know, they're kind of infuriating, of course. But on the other hand, they give me hope of change, because these are not something that cannot be changed. We have the data, and we just have to act on it to build better processes. Unfortunately, what often happens is that instead we focus on things like mentoring women or having science camps for girls, like somehow they're not interested in science, or we have, you know, work-life balance kinds of approaches to, you know, help women balance their family time versus work better. So if you think about it, the common pattern in all of those is that we're aiming at the women, as in fix them, make them somehow better, rather than thinking about, well, how will mentoring change the wage gap? And why are we talking about work-life balance for women where we're not at all addressing the same issues for men in terms of having time to spend at home versus at work and so on? So I think my feeling is we need to be a little more scientific about approaching the issue itself, where we know what the problems are. There's been lots of assessments and surveys, and yet our solutions are not aligned with what we are learning from these surveys. So instead of addressing the systemic problems, the, you know, biases, the questions around, you know, whether or not women have the skills, these are actually unconscious biases. So we have to address the biases and we have to fix all these structural issues and not just focus on fix the women. Let's fix the system instead.
In the course of describing the lives of these women scientists, you also describe what their personal relationships were like. Even sometimes you don't have, there's not very much information available and you're doing some digging. And you also discuss how your own relationship with your partner has impacted your career. Why did you feel it was important to include this kind of information in this book?
Well, I do focus certainly on the scientific journeys of these women and their contributions to these big discoveries. But I think that it's time for us to tell that bigger story. As you mentioned, it's not that we can be only physicists or only human beings. Of course, physicists are human beings. So we have these broader identities. We have personal lives. We have passions outside of, you know, our science and our work. So it is important to bring that full story into science. Although, of course, often, I personally, as a physicist myself, I'm not always comfortable bringing that all into the workplace because we think of, you know, physics, I mean, science in general, but particularly physics as this objective field where we have to be rational and we have to, you know, leave everything else behind. And that's really not true because, of course, I do physics because I love it. I'm very passionate about it. I bring all my emotions actually to work, but I don't feel like super comfortable discussing it and sharing all of that. And I think perhaps that's not really helpful because, you know, we should be able to bring all of our various identities to our work. And in fact, all our different experiences shape our perspectives. And the more varied perspectives we can have, perhaps we can find new ways to, you know, approach all of these big global challenges. So that's why I wanted to tell the stories also of these women's personal lives and their struggles. And you're right that there isn't that much information on some of these women. And they too did not actually perhaps feel comfortable discussing it because I couldn't find a lot of personal memoirs around those kinds of topics. But I certainly got a sense of how much they loved their work, how they would get frustrated, certainly by their own challenges that they faced. Their joys, the fact that they supported each other, the fact that they created grants and awards and, you know, all of these ways to, you know, celebrate women and, you know, set that example for the next generation. You get a sense of who these women are and who they were as in their personal lives as well through that.
Do you have a list of contemporary women physicists who might deserve the kind of attention that you've given to the researchers of past generations in your book?
Oh, that's a great question. So I haven't started thinking about writing another such book, but you're absolutely right, of course. There are lots of contemporary women, and that's actually good news that there's many more women to talk about now than perhaps in the past. And I hope that number keeps growing, and it doesn't depend on which area. In fact, if I were to write such a book again, I would probably want to even focus in not just on all the big physics discoveries, but on in a particular field such as my own, quantum, because there are enough women who have been contributing that I'd be, you know, I'd want to be able to collect enough stories to write a whole book just on one area. And I think that's true in all of the areas of physics. Women are doing physics all around the world, and there's so many stories that are worth celebrating.
Tell me about your own research in quantum physics. Is it relevant to quantum computing or other quantum-based applications, or is it more in the line of just furthering our basic understanding of the quantum world?
It's a bit of both. So I'm a theoretical physicist, so I don't go and build quantum computers myself, but I do think about what are the resources that we can use if we wanted to do useful tasks with quantum computers. Why would a quantum computer, for example, work better than a regular computer? There are certain, you know, very specific quantum properties that I think you may have heard of, things like quantum entanglement. I know it's in the popular culture a lot these days. And that's this weird property how, of how two particles that have perhaps interacted at some point or have been created by some physical process, when you separate out the particles and take them to opposite ends of the universe, they remain connected. So that if you measure one particle, then the other particle also feels the impact of that measurement in some way. So that's a very weird thing, of course, to think about this kind of instant kind of connection. So given that, it sounds almost like sci-fi, of course, but we can now think of it as a knob that we can use to do better computing and even do interesting kinds of communication protocols such as quantum teleportation, believe it or not. It's not like Star Trek teleportation. You can't actually teleport people, but you can actually teleport data from one location to another. So those are the kinds of questions that I like to think about. And exploring how we can use the laws of quantum physics to do better computing and communication actually does help us understand what this theory is all about and how do the fundamental laws of the universe really work and what is our place in it. So that's what drives me.
Back to science fiction and pop culture, are there types of depictions of women scientists and pop culture that make you cringe? And also part two of that question, yes, you're saying yes. Part two, and are there good examples of women scientists and sci-fi stories?
Ooh, that's a great question. So one of my favorites is Contact by Carl Sagan. The book as well, and I mean, the movie was pretty great too, with Jodie Foster plays the main scientist in there. And I'm very excited to say that I did get to meet the actual woman that character was based on, Jill Tarter. And she's, you know, wonderfully inspiring woman. So I like that because it was so closely based on an actual scientist. And, you know, the science was great, of course, because, you know, Carl Sagan was the author there. Bad science, I mean, there's so many examples. The one that I wasn't happy about recently, not really about the portrayal of women scientists per se, but just quantum science in general, was the recent movie, Marvel movie, Quantumania, because other than the word quantum, there was nothing quantum in that movie at all. So, I mean, it was fun, but it's hard to reconcile the, you know, being a quantum physicist. I know that these movies are entertaining and they actually help in terms of spreading the word about quantum, but that's really not quantum, what quantum is at all.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with us. We've really enjoyed having you on the show. Just our last question for you. What are you reading or watching or listening to that you can recommend to our listeners?
Wow. I'm honestly, right now, I've been so busy that I've been waiting to pick up any new books. As far as shows go, I'm really looking forward to watching Lessons in Chemistry, which I think has just been released. I you know, was reading the book, and of course, it is also a book that features a woman scientist, a chemist. So that's exciting, and it's a really fun read. So I'm looking forward to watching the TV show.
Well, I thank you for Lessons in Physics today and shedding a light on unexplored chapters of the history of physics. And so thanks so much, Shohini, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
For more about Shohini Ghosh and about the women physicists profiled in her book, check out my blog posting on cosmiclog.com. There's even a link to the TED Talk that started it all. And while you're online, check out dominicafetaplace.com. Don't worry about the spelling, just follow the link from Cosmic Log. Thanks to Shohini Ghosh and to Katie Lewis at the MIT Press for setting up the interview, and thanks to James Emley, the rocker scientist, for his rendition of the fiction science theme music composed by yours truly. Please subscribe to our Fiction Science podcast and feel free to give us a stellar rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your favorite podcast channel happens to be. And so until next time, this is Alan Boyle advising you to watch the skies.